This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
So now welcome into the big picture where we peer into the crystal ball and try to tell you what's happening out there in the world. It's part of the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here. And you know, the theme of the big picture, aside from crystal ball peering, is to focus on the larger view of the markets and the economy. And we try as best as we can to project things forward, looking into the future, to give you the analysis of what might happen and alert you to ideas or trends that present opportunity versus danger. Now, if you've been following the big picture in Financial Sense News Hour for a long time, you remember that we warned you of problems in the markets before. We talked about the tech bubble, the housing bubble, and the mortgage crisis. We predicted that well in advance, as well as opportunities in commodities over the last decades, and of course, dividend-paying stocks in this decade. Last year, when the stock market was a one-way ride up, we did warn that the next bubble in bull market would be in passive index funds, which are currently, of course, the investment fad. And so today, what we're going to do is alert you to the one big risk out there that very few people seem to be discussing. It's liquidity in the markets. And according to Goldman Sachs person Charles Himmelberg, liquidity is the new leverage.
What's kind of interesting and what prompted this week's show, we didn't have time to really get into the weeds because last year, one of the big things we said, the next bubble was in index funds. But this show was prompted by a recent interview I did with Don Cox. And it was a question I posed to him about what was going on in the markets. In other words, what is it out there that nobody's thinking about? Because anytime you get into a bear market, there's always one factor that nobody sees or could see it coming. Just as in the last decade, all those illiquid mortgages that were sold to the public as being AAA rated, well, turned out they weren't AAA rated. So let's begin with that clip once again, because it is really what prompted today's show.
This could be the first example of what it's going to be like for the rest of the economy as technology advances. You know, for decades we've been saying, what happens if we have robots running companies? Okay? You know, that's been talked about and we've had various scholars looking at it. But we haven't had a test case yet where that happens. So it's not going to be in this case that the 500 stocks in the S&P had a huge percentage of them run totally by robots. It's going to be that the pricing and the valuing of what they do is being done in a robotic fashion, taking out the great safety mechanism, which is that you've got so many millions and millions of people making individual decisions about pricing. It reminds me of that first attempt at this, which was just when I came into the business in the early 70s, and using the power of a gigantic computer of the time, which had about the same strength as my laptop now. The forecast was made for economic growth, and this was a big thing that was announced. And then the Arabs invaded Israel, oil prices quadrupled, and we went into a recession. And so it blew it out. And they said, what went wrong? And they said, well, we had 200 factors that we used in our forecast, but since there had been no change in oil prices for decades, we didn't include oil prices as a factor. So what will the factor be that somebody said, well, isn't worth feeding into the system?
And that factor that Don Cox identified in that interview as the unknown, I believe I know what it is, at least in my own opinion. Plain and simple, it is liquidity. And my job today is to warn you of the consequences. There are three factors that are driving this liquidity risk. One is the dominance of high-frequency trading, which dominates most trades on a daily basis. Number two, an issue we identified last year, is the passive index investing fad and bubble. And number three, government regulations. So we got three factors that are driving this risk, and this to me is the big risk, as in the words of Goldman, liquidity is the new leverage if we head into another downturn.
Let's begin with one of those three. The first one was high-frequency trading.
If you look at the markets that trade on a daily basis today, almost 90% of daily trading on exchanges is dominated by high-frequency trading in index investing. That's where all the money is going. In the words of Don Cox, markets are no longer driven by humans, but by machines. And machines know the price of everything, but the value of nothing. We first approached this subject last year out of curiosity. At the beginning of last year, I started delving into some of the FANG stocks, and I was thinking, who in their right mind would be paying these kind of prices for these stocks? And as I did more and more research, I found that the vast majority, the top 10 holders of all these stocks were all index funds. And it just wasn't the FANG stocks. As I moved further into the market and took a look at some of the market leaders in technology and some of the other areas like consumer cyclicals at that time, I would look at the top 10 owners. They were all index funds, and we're going to get into that when we get into indexing. But where this becomes a problem is when there is a modest fundamental news event. Think of, for example, January 26th, when the start of the big swoon that we saw in stock prices. That Friday, there was an unemployment report that showed that wage income increased year over year by 2.9%. So here was this fundamental story that came out of an economic report, and it set off stocks down by 12% in 6 days and blew up the volatility funds, which lost 80 and 90% of their value. So imagine when you have something that's a major economic or macro event, or even worse, a monetary event. Think back to May of 2013, when Bernanke for the first time announced that the Fed was going to start tapering its purchases. Think back to a macro event back in 2013 in May of that year, when Fed Chairman at that time, Ben Bernanke, alerted to the market, instead of printing money, the Fed was going to start reducing or the taper. The taper tantrum sent bond yields doubling in a period of 3 months. In both cases, the market rapidly went in a downward direction, a correction to, let's say, a minor news event becomes magnified by this lightning-like moves that we see trading and this high-frequency trading as the HFT traders withdraw liquidity from the market. This is an example where machines, not humans, are making trading decisions. And of course, the problems with machines trading algorithms are more limited than humans in their ability to process, let's say, complex macro information. For example, when the market finally figured out, okay, they're going to do this gradually, it's going to be over time, guess what? The stock market went up. It didn't go down. Bond yields, which had nearly doubled, finally came down and hit an all-time record low in history in the summer of 2016. Also think of, for example, the monetary announcement in March of 2009, when the Fed announced for the first time quantitative easing to the tune of $1.2 trillion. Think of how that flipped the market. The results is we're seeing more instances where this occurs in this decade as the machines take over the market. So let me just give you a couple examples. The flash crash in May of 2010. The 10-year Treasury crash in October of 2014. The British pound crash in October of 2016. And the VIX spike in February of this year. And these are just a few examples. And we've seen them in the past, but not as frequent. We had it in 1994 with the peso crisis. We had it once again in 1997 with the Asian crisis, where the Dow lost 8% in a single day. And in 1998, once again, the Dow lost 8% when the news about Russia's debt default and long-term capital management's bankruptcy. And so these are just a few events.
If we compared the crashes from back then, where the Dow took a pretty precipitous dive, and given the level of where the markets are today, if we took the equivalent dive today, what would it look like?
Well, I mean, you know, on this Friday, we've got the Dow at 24,750, a little over 750. If you had an 8 to 10% crash in a single day, John, that would be a 2,000-point drop in the Dow. Can you imagine what the news headlines would be that evening if the Dow dropped? I mean, you know, today we see the Dow go down 200 points, 500 points. Believe it or not, folks, when you're dealing with the 25,000 Dow, that is really a minor event. 2,000, 2,500, or 4,000, or 5,000, like we saw in the crash of 87. Now, that would get a lot of people's attention. But if that event was to occur in another flash crash, where you would see that kind of drop to a major macro event like we did in Asia, or Russia's debt default, that's what it would look like. It wouldn't be pretty.
Well, I guess we have to ask whether or not these flash crashes that we are seeing are actually an indicator that something is not quite right. You know, you get like with volcanic eruptions, we've had these eruptions in Hawaii going on, and they may be harbingers of something bigger to come.
And John, here's another thing I want to bring out, and we're going to do, stay tuned next week, by the way, where we're going to do a extensive piece on the bond market. But it's not just the stock market, it's the bond market, and it's across a wide spectrum of markets that now are run by machines, from the price of livestock, lumber, grains, energy. Just look at what happened to oil on Friday, to just an announcement, which I think is a lot of noise at this time, to currencies, interest rates, precious metals. So it's not just high frequency trading is the stock market. It's spreading across every asset class in the world, including the biggest asset class, which is currencies. So algorithms are replacing people, and speed is replacing capital, according to Goldman Sachs. You know, you take a look at the volume of trading today by HFTs that operate with a thin amount of capital, giving the trading volume that they're doing, their capital is so small, they have a very small cushion to protect them against adverse losses, which you can see when these kind of flash crashes occur. So that during an adverse market condition, you could see the collapse of liquidity caused by outsized price declines. Because when prices drop like they do in these flash crashes, all of a sudden, everything sort of freezes up. There goes your liquidity. Nobody wants to step in. Nobody wants to buy. And that's what we have seen in these declines that are becoming more frequent. And as I mentioned, it's across all asset classes, this high frequency trading, because we've seen a flash crash in stocks in 2010, a flash crash in treasuries in 2014, a flash crash in currencies in 2016 with the British pound, and a spike in the VIX in February of this year. So it is spreading. It is not contracting. And to put this in perspective, what you have to think of is prices decline rapidly as a result of HFT trading. Liquidity evaporates. Basically, the HFTs become liquidity takers. Liquidity dries up in the markets until whatever fundamental news or shock is cleared up. So the drop in price becomes a negative feedback loop, which feeds on itself. A good example I could give you is the taper tantrum that took place in 2013. You know, in 3 months, the treasury market, the yields on treasuries doubled. And then all of a sudden, it went away. And that's because the understanding of this macro event was cleared up. And we went on from yields doubling from one, let's say 1.5% to almost 3%. To basically a couple of years later, we hit the lowest record level of interest rates in human recorded history.
Why don't you give a real world example of what this looks like?
Well, let me just give you an example of how this takes place. Let's suppose, and we'll call the stock ABC. ABC stock is trading at $10 a share. Now, below $10 a share, which is the market price, you may have traders or investors in there that have bids at, let's say, $9.75, $9.50, $9.25, $9. Then once you get 10% below the market price, below 10, you've got a few bids, but they get smaller and there's less in size. So what happens is when you get a flash crash, all of a sudden you just blow through all those bids from $10 to $9 to, let's say, $8.50. And then all of a sudden below $8.50, there are no bids. So it takes somebody that has, let's say, the intestinal fortitude to just go in there and say, you know what? That $10 stock, which is trading at 6 or 7 right now, I'm going to go buy. And all of a sudden you get your first bid. But until you get those first bids coming in, the thing just keeps falling. Picture an elevator loaded with people on the 100th floor. It keeps dropping until somebody presses a button that they want to get off at a certain floor, and that's when your bids come in. Let me give you a real example of that. In the flash crash that took place in 2010, one stock, a very liquid large cap stock in the Dow, Procter & Gamble, in a period of 15 minutes, went from $48 all the way down to $30. That was a drop of 37% on a major Dow stock in 15 minutes. Now, at the end of the day, it closed at $47, or roughly $1 lower. But between that 15-minute period, when the flash crash was occurring, when liquidity dried up, there were no bidders that came into that stock. All the bids were blown out until you got down to around $30 when somebody stepped in and started buying. But in a 15-minute period, Procter & Gamble lost nearly 40% of its value.
Yeah, and so what this means is that when everything's dropping, it continues to fall until somebody decides to step in and buy, because nobody's buying at that point.
No, because when liquidity dries up, stock prices crash through the floor in a matter of minutes as these machines take over, driving prices down rapidly as liquidity begins to vanish. Because liquidity, there's always got to be a buyer there. Well, when nobody's buying, it keeps falling. That's when liquidity basically disappears, because everybody is afraid to step up in front of a falling knife. And in the example of Procter & Gamble, when the stock lost 40%, somebody finally put in a bid, and that's when it stopped. So the feedback loop kicks in as investors, and here's the psychological part that comes in. This feedback loop kicks in as investors interpret this price decline as confirmation that there must be news out there that's really bad. And what does this lead to? It leads to that herd instinct as prices decline further, as people begin to sell and the herd mentality takes over.
And I'm guessing here that the trigger is usually some little event that nobody's thinking about, like, you know, in January, remember the wage report comes out and all of a sudden, boom, everything's down 10%. And that was just the event that triggered it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, bull markets are escalator rides. Bear markets are elevator rides. And picture yourself, you're in a 100-story building. You're on the 100th floor. It's time to get off work. You get in the elevator and you notice the elevator is totally packed. You're the last person they can squeeze in. And you just happen to look over on the sign where the buttons are on the floors and it says elevator capacity, 2,500 pounds, and you notice there's 10 people weighing 250 pounds on the elevator, and you're the last guy to get on. And that's what happens. The elevator just drops and drops and drops until finally somebody pushes the button, says, you know what, we're on the 100th floor, I'll get off on the 60th floor. And I don't know if any of you have ever been to some of the big skyscrapers that we have around this country. I remember, I think it's the John Hancock or the Sears building in Chicago. I think it's 110 floors. I forget how many floors it was. And I just remember taking that ride up. And as you get out of the elevator, just the amount of air that kind of pushes you out and getting back in. That's what these flash crashes look like.
You know, I do remember the blast of air getting off the elevator there in Chicago. It's funny you should mention that. I thought, wow. I think this gets back to what Don Cox said in the interview you did with him, because we no longer have humans making decisions, and they currently, the algorithms can't process the more sophisticated concepts and things that are going on.
No, when complex fundamental macro information enters the market, human traders gain the information advantage as HFTs pull back and exit the markets, and they stay out of the markets, which dries up liquidity. When uncertainty clears up, then the HFTs come back. So you take a look at the flash crash. When HFTs pull out of the market and the price of Procter & Gamble dropped from $47 or $48 down to $30, it was a human being, some portfolio manager or investor came in there and said, you know what? It just went from $48 to $30. There's no fundamental reason for that. I'm going to step in and buy. And that's where humans have the advantage over machines.
But what if, in the future, this fundamental uncertainty just hangs in there like a cloud and doesn't clear up?
This is probably right now one of the biggest unknowns. HFTs have not been stress test, just as those mortgages in the last decade weren't stress test, so they blew up when the financial crisis hit. So we really don't know how they'll react to, let's say, a recession and economic stress. Flash crashes are all in bull markets that we've seen so far, and we are in the middle of an economic recovery. So right now, I guess all we can say is we simply don't know how this will play out. It has never been stress tested before.
Last year, you were talking about identifying index funds as the next bubble. And when we went to our three factors involving this risk, passive index investing was number two. So let's switch over to that one now.
I mean, if you look at the stock market today, index funds account for 43% of all stock fund assets. Think about that for a minute. Indexing now makes up 43% of the market, and it is expected to rise to 50% in the next 3 years, according to Barron's. In total, index funds represent $7 trillion in U.S. stock funds that don't have a manager actively evaluating its holdings. Buying and selling is done automatically without any human thought to any of the fundamentals. This is what first drove me to look into this early on last year, because I simply was just scratching my head with reminiscence of the tech bubble when people were just paying outlandish premiums for some of these stocks. I'm saying, who in their right mind is doing this? And that's when I discovered. So that's why, as a result of indexing, you're seeing Amazon today selling at 200 times earnings, or Netflix selling at 234 times earnings. I mean, it's really mindless investing, just like high frequency trading, as active managers really die off because active management has gone out of fashion. A lot of funds are closing up, money's coming out, and it's going back into indexes. And basically, as that happens, the market's ability to price companies diminishes. In a recent interview, in fact, the front cover of last week's Barron's, Jack Bogle, the founder, inventor of index funds, and one of the founders of Vanguard, said, and I quote, "The likely result of everybody indexing is chaos, chaos without limit." And that's a direct quote from the founder of index funds in Vanguard, Jack Bogle. And here's something that'll even put this, and this was another show that we did last year on financial concentration in the markets. Now, think about what I'm about to say. Ownership of stocks concentrated in the S&P 500 is three companies: Vanguard, BlackRock, and State Street. And if you want to take that, then they represent about 88% of the S&P 500. Throw in two others, Schwab and Fidelity, and that makes up over 90% of the largest shareholders of the S&P 500 are basically now in the hands of five companies. So you have not only just the liquidity issues, you also have the concentration issues that are thrown in there. And let's talk about another risk, is indexing has spread to the bond markets. The largest bond mutual funds, ETFs, have invested 15% or more of their money in rarely traded securities. In a recent Wall Street Journal article, the funds own significant holdings of bonds that are seldom trading. And here comes the problem. You get into a crisis, the crux of the problem is that mutual funds own more bonds that seldom trade than ever before, but they're still promising to pay out investors within 7 days of redemption, a promise they may not be able to fulfill in the next downturn or crisis. And it gets worse than that. Another issue is capacity. Some of these ETFs have taken on so much money, they have become too big for the indexes they represent. Now, let me give you an example. VanEck Vector's Junior Mining Index, which is GDXJ, the $5 billion ETF owns more than just juniors. They had to expand the fund holdings that weren't in the index because they were creating a significant divergence. They had to expand the index, but you had this small pool of stocks where they would become not only major shareholders owning the vast majority, and you get into ownership problems when you do that. And also, as a mutual fund, they have to deal with liquidity issues, and that's why they expanded the universe. So the big issue here is, once again, capacity, as ETFs have gotten bigger than the universe they cover.
And if we cycle it around to bonds, bonds could suffer liquidity issues just like stocks would in the next downturn.
Oh, sure. I mean, just think what happens in a severe downturn. Think of 2015 and 2016, where you're a fund manager, you get liquidation notices, people panic. Well, what happens is your liquid bonds are the first to go. You sell those because you have liquidity in those bonds. Now you're stuck with the illiquid bonds in your portfolio, and they become a larger percentage of what you own. And these are the bonds you can't get rid of in 7 days. And to make matters worse, regulation has reduced the number of Wall Street firms and bond trading desks with traditional sources of liquidity. And illiquidity in mutual funds and ETFs can be especially dangerous because individual investors typically move in herds. And when herds move, they move in mass, and they could force these funds to dump assets that could have a major impact on prices. Because when you're trying to get liquid, you keep dropping the price until finally you get a buyer to step up. And the other issue is the ownership concentration. Now, picture you're in a room. You're BlackRock, you're Vanguard, you're State Street. You are the largest owners, representing 88% of the ownership of the S&P 500. You go to sell, you're all thinking of selling at the same time. Answer me this question. Who do you sell to?
And it would seem, Jim, that therein is the problem. It is the market, you know. This was highlighted in that conversation you had earlier in the week with Daniel DiMartino.
Clearly, the situation you have in the stock market is going to be magnitudes worse when it comes to the credit market, simply because liquidity mismatch is going to be that much more acute. So again, Janet Yellen, it was a very rare moment for her. Years ago, she expressed alarm about two different things: biotechnology stocks, which have pretty much corrected at this point, and high yield ETFs. Now, this is a woman who, for the most part, market data made her eyeballs roll into the back of her head. So the fact that somebody at the New York Fed markets desk had brought to her attention how very dangerous high-yield ETFs were was saying something, that she was actually publicly expressing anxiety in what could potentially happen in the event of a market disruption. Again, we don't know. We simply have no idea. And making matters that much worse is Dodd-Frank, which disincentivized banks years ago from holding bonds on their balance sheet. We know that bond inventories have completely collapsed. They've gone from over $250 billion to about $30 billion on big broker-dealer balance sheets. That means that the backstops that have been in place in prior downturns are not there anymore, so there's even less of a cushion, despite the fact that we're talking about the ETF structure. So, you know, again, I worry about mom-and-pop investors who have bought into bond ETFs, thinking that this is the most cost-effective way to invest in the safest securities in my portfolio. If you think about how disorienting it will be to them that they will suffer the greatest capital losses in some of these bond funds.
You know, as Daniel said there in that interview with FS Insider, it's not just a liquidity issue. A lot of these funds and ETFs own low quality or distressed debt. And a lot of them own bonds that are rated CCC or triple C and lower, meaning they are just one step closer to default. Now, they're doing okay right now because they're able to get finance and, you know, we're still in a bull market and we're still in an economic recovery. But they could suddenly freeze up and become illiquid in a flash crash or a downturn. A good example was this year with high yield ETF HYG in that late January, February downturn in market swoon, 10% of HYG, the money came out of that ETF, forcing liquidation. So this is just an example of something we don't really know. Is a lot of my guests said, and especially the one I did this week with Danielle, is they've never been stress test before. And that Goldman report that came out in January, they made similar references. We simply don't know at this time.
Okay, so those are two factors behind liquidity risk. Number one being high frequency trading, which is dominating right now in daily trading. Number two, passive index investing. And let's move on to number three, government regulation.
This goes back, John, to the financial crisis back in 2008. As asset prices plummeted, investors found out that the banks that sold them all this garbage were unwilling to buy it back, whether it was stocks, bonds, or the toxic mortgage securities that were sold as AAA investments. They were simply unwilling to buy them back, and investors were left holding the bag as liquidity dried up. So after the crisis, legislation came in with Dodd-Frank that put restrictions that held back bank trading desks. And since Dodd-Frank has passed, so the markets today, you have bond ETFs, which are at historic highs. They're greater in the first quarter. They totaled over $3.6 trillion, up $2 trillion since 2008. While bond dealers' inventories have fallen from 4% of outstanding bonds to a mere 0.5% today. They've basically gone from about $250 billion down to $30 billion. And there are additional reasons behind the drop, one being efforts of the big trading house, like let's say Deutsche Bank and Barclays, are selling their inventory because they have to meet capital requirements. That was another thing that came in with the regulators. So bond trading has also become less lucrative as prices become more transparent. Regulators are requiring banks to pay for more risks that they run, and investors have become savvier. I mean, we have a Bloomberg, we deal with 30 of the world's largest bond dealers. So we can see how a bond is priced because it's transparent. I can look at, let's say we're going to buy ABC bond. I can look at who's carrying the bond, how much they have in inventory, and the prices that they're paying for it. So we can buy that bond at the cheapest price for our clients, which means the yield is better. This has led banks basically, they're losing interest. The regulations have increased. Not only that, the interest rates have fallen on bonds. So they're not holding bonds and inventory the way they used to. Instead, they dump them to investors or institutions rather than hold them in inventory. It's also, John, it's not just the U.S. This phenomenon is going global. This week, a big story coming out of Europe is the rise of banks that are giving up their primary dealership roles in dealing in European government bonds. So you have another liquidity issue that's rising in Europe in sovereigns, which threatens to further reduce liquidity and eventually make it more expensive for some countries to end up borrowing money. Increased regulations and lower margins have seen six of the major bond dealers exit various countries' debt markets. In recent months, we've seen more banks that are set to follow, further eroding the infrastructure which governments rely on to raise money. And these primary dealers are integral to the functioning of a government bond market. Credit Suisse just pulled out of most European countries. ING just quit Ireland. Commerce Bank has just left Italy. And Belgium did not reappoint Deutsche Bank. So the regulatory framework is unfortunately becoming more and more restrictive, which is acting to further reduce liquidity in the government bond markets. Remember, liquidity is when you want to sell, there's always a buyer on the other end. The net result, and we're seeing this play out this week and probably next week, is a lot of the Dodd-Frank regulations really put a chokehold on a lot of small banks and trading decks, which raised bank capital and restricted trading, which makes the financial system more vulnerable to a market panic. And that is the problem. Regulators are a poor judge of risk. Now Congress is in the process of reversing this right now.
And that's one of the bills that's been working its way through Congress, which is the reducing of regulations for community and regional banks. I was talking to the owner of a bank recently, and he was saying they're just having an awful time trying to keep up with the Dodd-Frank regulations. So this will provide some relief. Bigger banks have the capacity to do that.
But, you know, John, this still leaves many other markets like the municipal bond market vulnerable to liquidity risk, as muni bonds are not actively traded in the secondary market. Most people that buy individual muni bonds, whether a mutual fund or ETF or individual investors, they buy and hold them. So more importantly, municipal government finances can deteriorate quickly, which is what we found out in the financial crisis. Think of Orange County's bankruptcy in 1994. Think of the number of cities in California that went belly up on their muni bonds. And think of the show that we did earlier this year on Moody's report on the state of the states. We have 15 states in this country that are could be in deep financial trouble in the next financial crisis. And you have probably another 10 that could also find themselves getting in trouble, including my own state of California. Now, Congress is also retooling the bank leverage ratio, allowing banks to reduce their capital requirements. It just, you know, you have to scratch your head. You're coming towards the end of a business cycle. The markets, there's more debt out there than ever before, and now they're reducing capital ratios. Let me talk about two other issues that affect liquidity as well. And these are some that you're not even aware of as an investor. Two other rules may also impact leverage and liquidity. SEC, when all the money began pouring into bond funds after the financial crisis, the SEC saw as everybody was scrambling in search of yield, as the Fed continued quantitative easing, driving long-term rates lower, every manager was out there scrambling to get as high a yield as they possibly could, because that's what investors were doing when they were shopping for a bond fund. They would look at the bond fund that had the highest yield. Well, how did they get the highest yield? They did that by basically buying illiquid bonds. And they also basically, at least in like in our business, where we can take a look at large trades and monitor them and we have information. Well, guess what? The SEC, it basically went to the mutual fund companies and they said, look, you guys are buying illiquid bonds. And what we want you to do is categorize your portfolio into four buckets. One being the least liquid. And if you have more than 15% of illiquid bonds, they go into bucket number one. And then obviously four being the most liquid. Well, guess what? The mutual fund companies were saying, well, this puts us at a disadvantage. What if we say a bond is in bucket two, but it would really turned out to be in bucket one in an economic downturn, we could get sued. So the SEC comes in and said, well, just tell us. You don't have to tell the investors. Another SEC rule, which is in trial right now, is getting rid of transparency. They're basically saying, if you do bond trades that are $10 million and above, you don't have to report that trade in the price for 48 hours. So they're trying to take away transparency. It just goes to show you, John, what makes matters worse is regulators. They don't understand risk and don't often understand the consequences of their own action. What's going on regulatory-wise in Europe and what went on here is shrinking bond market liquidity, and this becomes important, and the government doesn't even realize this. They're shooting themselves in the foot because the government is dependent on a very liquid, transparent market to sell its bonds, and especially now when you consider that we're heading back to trillion-dollar deficits here in the U.S.
Let's see if we can tie this together now. We've covered these three points. Let's tie this together from the viewpoint of investors.
For investors, what this all means is they're having a tougher time trading in a number of financial markets. I don't care if it's bonds, stocks, or currencies, a development that is weakening their ability to raise cash or to protect against a big stock or bond decline. Another reason for less liquidity gets back to factor number two. Many investors are mere closet tracking bond indexes, and that's creating demand for newly issued bonds, which people like to get in and on, and same with institutions, but there's little appetite for the older bonds that trade in the secondary market. Now, as long as we're in a bull market, when these markets kind of seize up as they did at the beginning of 2016, it really poses an opportunity for institutions like ourselves, because you can go in if you have cash and you can buy these bonds at a discount as these funds are forced to liquidate at any price. So the problem is, as in all index funds, is investors or fund managers are trying to manage against an index, and that is everyone is chasing the same stuff. Everybody, if you're an index fund, the largest holding is Amazon in an S&P 500, guess what? You're all buying the same thing. You're all chasing the prices, and that's how we get these stocks selling at 200 times earnings.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you do believe that the Don Cox unknown factor, that which he says is unknown, you believe it to be in the risk that very few people are discussing. It's liquidity, basing that on three factors. HFT trading is number one, passive index investing, and number three, government regulation. And so we really have two or three themes floating through here, that index and passive funds form the new bubble in the financial markets, and liquidity, which we've been discussing here today, is the new risk. And especially the idea that if we look at risk and speak about it, that we have financial concentration where you have three entities owning, what, 88% of the S&P 500. That's a staggering amount. So given the fact that we do have this shockwave coming, not immediately, not imminently, but it's on its way, what are you doing in your firm to protect your clients and get ready for this?
You know, John, we're looking at things in this next downturn when it arrives, probably maybe end of the year, next year, we're thinking outside the box. What we've seen, as I've highlighted, is this breakdown of bond and stock reverse correlation. It's not working anymore. This old 60-40 rule. I mean, if you're in stock funds, you're probably down for the year. If you're in bond funds, you're probably down for the year. So one of the things that we're doing is we're using short-term, high-quality sovereign debt. We're not going to be owning that in a fund. We own it individually. We're also using interest rate floaters that take advantage of every Fed rate hike. So when interest rates go up, let's say the Fed raises interest rates a quarter of a point, let's say next month, our floating rate bonds are going to go up by a quarter of a point. We will probably, as we get closer to that time, we'll be using protective shorts and defensive equities. And so, you know, this is one where you're going to have to think outside the box. The old rules are not going to work in this next downturn, just as we found a lot of that didn't work in 2008, nor did it work in 1987.
So given this oncoming crisis, are you concerned? I mean, does it keep you up at night?
Well, I mean, when we first started looking at it, sure it did. But, you know, we figured this next one out. We're calling it our ARC strategy. Now, here's the good news about this. Yields are rising, so you don't have to sacrifice income, because there's a lot of people out there that are retired and relying on their investments for income. The good news is you can still be safe and you don't have to sacrifice income. Yields, as Richard Dixon pointed out in hour one, are better than dividends in most cases. And if you're buying the right kind of bonds, they're guaranteed. And, you know, we'll probably at some point be putting in some kind of short to ride out the storm. But here's the good thing. You know, it's just like a good sailor. When you know the weather forecast says there's a storm out there, you stay in port. And what does that mean to you as an investor? You get yourself liquid and in position where you can still protect your principal without sacrificing your income. And you're going to get income this time where, you know, I couldn't have said that 2 or 3 years ago. But here's the positive thing about this is I love bear markets, because bear markets, everything goes on sale. Who wouldn't be excited? And I've never understood this. If you read in the papers tomorrow or heard on the news, Nordstrom's was having a sale, marking down everything by 40, 50, and 60%. Everybody would be lined up to get into Nordstrom's when the store opened. I've never understood it. Why? When the stock market goes on sale and is discounted by 40, 50, and 60%, as it was in 2009, nobody wants to buy. Instead of buying at a discount, they go in the opposite direction. Nope. Why don't you get back to me when I can pay full price or above price? So, I mean, if you are prepared, there's nothing to fear. Your capital will be safe. You will have income. And the one caveat I would say is if you're a pre-retiree, you can't afford to go through another downturn like we did in 2000 or in 2008. So you should be talking to your advisor to have a plan B, or at least have some kind of exit plan.
Well, Jim, it's been an extensive analysis of this risk. And as you said, few people are discussing it. So this is an early warning for all of our listeners. Coming up in the weeks ahead, what are we looking towards?
I am going to do an extensive big picture next week, all on the bond market, because this is a subject matter that deserves its own special big picture event. It's going to be extensive, and it's going to have a lot of stuff that is going to shock you, and that'll be coming up next week. Well, next month, the Fed is widely expected to raise interest rates for the seventh time, another quarter of a point. That's going to be good news if you own floating rate bonds, but it's going to be important. This one will be accompanied by a press conference, so everybody's going to be looking, what are they going to do? The markets are anticipating they'll go four times. I don't think they are. I think they'll only go three times this year at most. But nonetheless, we've got the Fed meeting coming up on June. And of course, at the end of June, we will be getting into Q2 earnings season again and start it all over. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.